Support for WKAR is provided by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com. And by Douglas J., with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Mother's Day. DouglasJ.com.
Hey, welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad that you're here. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org with any feedback or show ideas that you might have. It's a new week, and last week's announcement of a proposed expansion of Jackson National Life Insurance's headquarters near Lansing has rekindled an interesting discussion, the idea of Lansing as a hub of the insurance industry. Four insurers, auto owners, Jackson National, the Accident Fund, and Farm Bureau Insurance, already employ at least 5,500 people in Lansing or the Lansing area. That's according to LEAP, the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. And the Jackson National plan, if it proceeds, would add about another 1,000. Here to explore the idea of branding Lansing as an insurance center, Prima Civitas founding executive and former Lansing Mayor David Hollister. Hi, David.
Good morning, Mark.
And Dr. Rick Cole is a professor and immediate past chairperson of the Department of Advertising, Public Relations, and Retailing here at Michigan State University's College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences. He had to come down one whole floor to join us here this morning, which makes it really, really convenient. Hi, Rick.
Good morning.
And we should also point out that before his current tenure here at Michigan State, Rick spent 15 years as an executive with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan and at the Detroit Medical Center. First off, David Hollister, what do you make of Jackson's proposal to expand in Aladdin Township? All good or what? What's your takeaway from that?
Win-win, all good, triple A, grand slam. I mean, you can't. It doesn't get any better than this. These are green jobs. These are good jobs. These are local jobs. They can't be exported jobs.
How are they green jobs?
That they are white collar.
Okay.
They're white collar. And
not manufacturing?
Not manufacturing,
yeah.
And it's environmentally pleasing. Based on investment strategies, and the founder, Bob Saltzman, who was there when I was mayor, had an idea of developing this. At one time, Jackson National was down on the south end of Lansing, kind of behind Capital Cadillac, you know, down there off South Pennsylvania.
Well, their data center is still there, isn't it?
Yeah, there's still an operation there.
Yeah.
And he was thinking of moving, and he was thinking about going to Denver when I engaged. And we then began looking at where he would relocate, because he was commuting from California. He was flying every week. He was flying in, spend the week here, and then fly home for the weekend. Mm. And there was an operation in Denver, and he was really thinking about relocating the whole operation when we then began looking at this 425. And the 425 agreement was looking at Aladdin Township and their rural green area that was being encroached upon by the expansion of East Lansing. And they were interested, the Aladdin folks, in protecting their green space. Bob was interested in an open environmental area where the employees would be able to stroll, and he had a vision of daycare, and he was into the arts, and was really he is a very creative guy. And we had to then convince the Aladdin community that this would not be a major detriment to their quality of life out there. And that's when I talk about green jobs. They originally opposed it. When Bob and I went out there the first night to speak to the Aladdin Township Board, the place was standing room only. There must have been 125 people there. And they booed us before we even got a chance to speak. They were,
how about that?
And there was actually a recall election on all of the township supervisors who voted to allow this to go in there, because he was promising green jobs, good jobs, expansion, daycare, quality of life. And they said, oh, it's too good to be true. We don't believe you. The
wow.
local township officials had enough courage to go forward based on the vision and the partnership. It was a win for the township, it was a win for the city, and clearly it was a win for Jackson National. And if you go out there, those employees are happy. They're delighted to have those jobs. They got a daycare center right on site. I mean, it's a model employer, and these are good-paying jobs, Mark. And starting jobs for an actuary, starting salary is around $90,000. These are good jobs.
Wow. Okay. As I mentioned, there are at least 5,500 people already working in the insurance sector in and near Lansing. Auto Owners Accident Fund, Farm Bureau Assurance, insurance among the biggest. Jackson National's proposal would grow the number by about 1,000. Here's what intrigues me most about this. It's great Jackson is growing, but is there a point at which, Rick Cole, the cluster of companies already here might lead to another company, a new company, relocating here?
Oh, I think so. And I think, as a matter of fact, you know, we could also add things like Delta Dental Plan and Mesa, the MEA insurance program, and well-established TPAs. It used to be Howard Wires, so WICO. I think they're still in operation here, and third-party administration, insurance administration, things like that. This is a great sector. We've got the university supporting this sector in the sense of providing some of the workers, and we know just today there was a piece in the Lansing State Journal about 600 IT jobs open in the greater Lansing area at this point in time. So what we're going to need to do if we want to get more businesses of this kind in is we're going to have to continue to focus on the educational resources. There's a hidden asset, by the way. Olivet College has America's only, I'm sure it's Michigan's only, insurance program. It's aimed directly at producing leadership for the insurance industry.
And they partnered with Cooley Law School to do some interesting stuff and to develop that as well.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And a lot of that was the result of a guy named Charles Trubeck, who used to be the regional president of State Farm, getting that going. So I think the big answer to your question is, obviously we can enhance this even more because we have the infrastructure here, as long as we're willing to grow it and expand it.
But when you talk infrastructure, now you're talking educational infrastructure, correct?
And quality of life.
Right.
Okay. But it's a different thing from manufacturing. It seems to me we're almost seeing the transformation of the local economy.
Diversification.
Diversification. Yeah. Right. Okay.
But, Mark, when I was mayor, I kept talking about Lansing being second only to Hartford, Connecticut, as far as the number of people involved in insurance. People didn't believe me at the time. It's taken almost 10 years for people to come to the realization that we are right there and we can compete on a national level for the brain power to come here.
How does Lansing, should Lansing actively promote this insurance sector outside of the area? Rick Cole, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the question is, you know, should this become sort of a regional brand? I think we could say we're actually, in many respects, already the Cadillac of the insurance industry.
Diversification here.
We really do have a tremendous base. The thing about branding a community is, and I've been involved in a number of these projects, is it has to be both credible and authentic. It's one thing, but it also has to be. You have to have the resources to continue to grow it. We are. Absolutely, right now, an insurance leader. There's no question about it. Dave recognized that, as he said 10 years ago. He also recognized the importance of having a vital automobile industry. And, you know, I've said this to Dave privately, and I'll say it, and I've said it publicly. If it wasn't for his leadership, I don't think Cadillac and Lansing would have the kind of marriage that it has right now and the kind of productive economic contribution that it's making to this community. Would you know just simply wouldn't exist without that kind of leadership.
I think that that's pretty well established. I'm curious, what would it take, though, for an insurance or financial services company in Connecticut, let's go right to the heart of the insurance industry or the traditional heart of the insurance industry in the United States, and actually get them to seriously think about coming to mid-Michigan?
I think quality of life is one of those. You know, we got the university, we got the state capital, we got lakes in every direction, and you've got to package it, and then you've got to have the quality training and workforce development strategy in place that's creating, and that's where the university adopting these curriculi that reinforce STEM and the IT jobs that are related. Most of these jobs are IT. And the interesting thing about getting back to these green jobs, they have flex time that people can work at home. They can come in, you know, they don't have regular offices. They've got cubicles that might be this part this time and another part of the building another time. So you just got to package that all up and then market the dickens out of it.
Let's talk about the tax breaks and incentives that need to happen. And Dave Hollister, you have a lot of experience in this area. Is 1,000 new jobs so desirable that governments might concede more than they should? Is that possible in this scenario?
I don't think so. First, the incentives have and continue to change, so you need all the tools you can get. We used it strategically on General Motors, as Rick has indicated. I think it's the difference between Lansing and Flint is so dramatic, and we were at that point, 15 years ago or whenever, when we faced that challenge. And had we not stepped up and put together the regional strategy and the economic package that included a 425 with Delta Township on the second plant, if we hadn't been creative and innovative and done that, we could be very much facing the same circumstances that Flint faces.
Rick Cole, you spent some years in the insurance industry at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. Give us your take on the auto insurance reform debate going on right now.
Well, I wasn't all that deeply involved in the in that, but I think what you have to be concerned about is the possible sort of corruption of the whole idea of insurance. When you start capping the benefits that in a sense exclude the most extreme catastrophic cases, you're in a sense kind of defeating the purpose of insurance, and you're creating a circumstance that I think is going to result in the government having to step in, which ultimately may turn out to be significantly more expensive than the current model. I'm not sure what people are trying to achieve by saying that once a person's claim reaches a certain level, the insurance company is no longer responsible for it. It doesn't make sense to me personally.
Dr. Rick Cole is professor and immediate past chairperson of the Department of Advertising, Public Relations, and Retailing here at Michigan State. And David Hollister is Prima Civitas founding executive and former mayor of Lansing. Rick and Dave, many thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
It's Current State on WKAR. Imagine for a minute that you run a restaurant and one of the world's most famous food personalities is about to eat your food.
Bourdain has three rules to travel by. Get hungry.
Spicy, sour, salty, savory.
Get curious.
Are you kidding me?
Get lost.
Mama didn't raise no fool.
Chef and author Anthony Bourdain has a new globetrotting TV show called Parts Unknown on CNN. On Tuesday, he brings his Guts and Glory speaking tour to MSU's Wharton Center. After his talk, he'll join 150 people for a VIP event at Red Haven, a new restaurant in Okemos. Current State Scott Pohl spoke with Red Haven owner Nina Santucci about feeding Anthony Bourdain. She's a big fan.
we first started talking about it in the kitchen, and we all kind of thought, you know, talking about it as if it was never really going to happen. Oh, how cool would it be for him to be sitting at our counter and we could cook for him? You know, it's one of those people who, if you have a list of 10 people that you could cook for, you know, he would be on it. But, you know, never thinking that any of those 10 would ever actually happen in reality. So, you know, we had a ton of fun with the idea, but always thinking that it probably wasn't really going to happen. And then we get a contract and sign in, that was it. So as far as how it happened, I'm pretty sure from what I've gathered that the Wharton Center recommended us to them. And, you know, I like to think that Anthony Bourdain looked at our website and said, yes, that's where I want to go. But in reality, it's probably not all that exciting, I'm sure. You know, they came here and stopped by the restaurant to check it out, and I think have done some research on us. But I like to think, and hopefully he won't tell me otherwise, that he's been a huge follower of ours for years.
Did he have any particular requests or demands?
Really, none at all. It was pretty cool when we were talking, you know, just a week or two ago with the folks from the Wharton Center and Anthony Bourdain's people, and he pretty much said that he wants to eat what everyone else is eating. He wants to drink what everyone's drinking. He doesn't want anything special brought to him. And I thought that was pretty awesome, you know, that he, you know, you kind of like to think anytime someone of that caliber comes, you want to do something extra special for them, which for us will be our entire menu. But, you know, for him to just kind of say, no, I don't want any special treatment. I want to be eating what everyone else is eating is, I think, is kind of shows, hopefully, a pretty good character for him.
Would I be right in guessing that because he's coming here for dinner after his appearance at the Wharton Center, that you won't be able to attend his show at the Wharton Center? You'll be here preparing that meal, I assume.
Unfortunately, that is true. Part of the deal with hosting the reception is that we got 4 tickets to the show, and something that I would love to go see, but unfortunately there's no way. I would be far too stressed to be sitting in there thinking about everything that needed to be happening at the restaurant to really make that happen.
Anthony Bourdain has a pretty well-earned reputation for loving what he loves and hating what he hates, and so it makes me wonder if you feel any particular nervousness or pressure in preparing a meal for him.
There's definitely, you know, if you really think about it, would be pretty awful for him to really not have positive things to say. I mean, even just having a non-reaction is kind of like, you know, a letdown. But I think, you know, we're putting out things that we feel really proud of, that we really like, and that we've had really positive response to that. I think if nothing else, you know, it may not be that he says this was the best meal I've ever had in my life, but I think we feel confident that he's gonna enjoy everything. And so we'll see. I mean, it's certainly, there is that could always happen, that he's just like, this is garbage, and he probably will say it. But that's the worst thing that can happen. And if nothing else, I'm still feeding Anthony Bourdain, so that's pretty exciting.
I'm picturing a certain level of tension in the kitchen. You fool, you left the potatoes on for a minute too long. That sort of thing. That's not likely, is it?
No, I think everyone, you know, when it comes down to crunch time, everyone's very calm and collected, and they just kind of put their heads down and get the job done. So I think he should hopefully be impressed kind of seeing, you know, how we put the food out and, you know, kind of take care of business in a sense.
So tell me a little bit about what you're planning. You have an extensive menu. We maybe can't cover all of it, but what are the highlights?
Well, so the way that the party will happen is that it's essentially cocktails. So everyone will be standing. There'll be, you know, lots of drinks and libations flowing, and then there'll be past hors d'oeuvres and some stationary hors d'oeuvres. So it's all, you know, a lot of finger food type items that can be consumed while standing. So some of it is things that we've done at the restaurant that, you know, we're really excited about, get a good response on, that also translates to eating while standing up. And then others are things that are off the menu. It's a very pork-heavy menu, so hopefully everyone's on board to eat quite a bit of pork that night.
He's a pork guy.
Yeah, I think he is. And I think most people who follow him, I can't imagine he's got a huge vegetarian following just based on the things that he says. So I think it should go over pretty well, but in general, I think we kind of try to highlight and showcase some ingredients that we get here in Michigan that we're pretty proud of. I mean, the night that he comes in, our main focus to kind of highlight, you know, Michigan as a whole. So we've worked with a lot of the different brewers that we work with and are getting, you know, really specialty beers that you only see once in a while. And, you know, can't imagine he's going to be able to drink every single one of them. But just to have him out there, you know, for people to see all the really cool stuff we're doing. And we try to kind of bring that through to the menu. So type of pork that's raised here in Michigan is the Mangalitsa pork. It's originally imported from Hungary, and it's raised and kind of prized on its fat. So most pigs that you get are about 90% meat, 10% fat, very lean. This pork, on the other hand, is 40% meat, 60% fat. So when you cut into it, you're going to be seeing inches of fat. But it's raised much longer than a conventional pig would be. And the flavor is incomparable. The color of the meat is more similar to a steak than it is of the pork that we're used to seeing. And so we brought in one of these pigs and have just kind of played around with all of its components. And you'll see different parts of the pig throughout the menu. So the lard we rendered down and smoked it. And then our baker is baking a Cuban bread with the smoked lard that's going to be served with some different condiments, similar to what we do at the restaurant. But this is, you know, this very awesome specialty bread that, you know, we'll only be pulling out for this. That same pig, a brewery up in Traverse City, Right Brain Brewery, takes the bones, smokes them, and makes almost a stock out of it, which in turn becomes a pig porter. And it's a smoky, rich, dark beer, really incredible. And we're using that beer to make one of our popular soups that we serve out of our food truck, our beer ham and cheese soup. So using a smoked ham stock, local cheddar cheese, and then that pig porter beer, and then we'll serve that in little shooters, top them with beer bubbles so it'll look like a frothy beer. And just kind of, you know, really bringing out all different components of this one animal, and you'll see it throughout, you know, all sorts of different courses in our menu. But I'll kind of tie together and show all different things that you can do with just one thing.
It's my understanding it's sold out, is that right?
Yes. One, we're not a huge restaurant, so there weren't a ton of tickets to begin with. But before we even announced that we were going to be the ones hosting the reception, the tickets had already all been completely sold. So I have to imagine that the people who are coming are real huge Bourdain fans because they got those tickets early. And so that's exciting because not only will we be cooking for him, but we're going to be cooking for hopefully a room full of foodies. And for me, there's no greater person to cook for than someone who truly appreciates and, you know, knows what goes into a lot of the dishes that we'll be putting out. So it's an exciting crowd to have the opportunity to showcase what you can do.
His new show is on CNN. Any idea if he's bringing a CNN crew with him?
I haven't heard anything about it. So my understanding, as far as I know, he's got just his one production person, maybe two that'll be with him. So it would be amazing if there was a camera crew, but I think what we can really hope for is that he likes the place enough that maybe he would consider bringing a camera crew at a later date. But I'm guessing he's on tour almost a different city every single day, that probably to do both at the same time might be a bit much. But you never know, and like I said, one can only hope that he has a good enough time that he feels it worth coming back to Lansing.
Well, if nothing else, you're on Current State on WKAR.
That's right.
Well, it sounds really exciting for someone like you to get an opportunity like this. Good luck on Tuesday night, and thank you again, Nina Santucci of the Red Haven.
Yep, thank you so much for having me.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Coming up on Current State, stick around. It's the 80th anniversary of Hammer and Hank Greenberg's debut with the Tigers. Peter Wharf visits with Greenberg author John Rosenberg and MLive's Angela Whitrock. And I revisit developer Pat Gillespie's situation with the City of Lansing and the Marketplace Project. That's all coming up on Current State. Thank you. Spring 1933. Duke Ellington celebrates his 34th birthday with his world-renowned orchestra. Mahatma Gandhi begins a three-week hunger strike. The first plane flies over Mount Everest. Beer sales return to some U.S. states as the full repeal of Prohibition nears. Germany's newly appointed Chancellor Adolf Hitler opens the Dachau concentration camp. And a young ball player from the Bronx starts his rookie campaign with the Detroit Tigers. This year marks the 80th anniversary of Hank Greenberg's first season. Greenberg's storied career is celebrated not only for his excellence on the diamond, but also for the adversity Hammer and Hank overcame during one of the world's most turbulent periods. The life and times of the Tiger great are described in depth in the new John Rosenberg book, Hank Greenberg, the Hero of Heroes. WKAR's Peter Wharf brings us the first of his two-part series with Rosenberg. John explains Greenberg's early career challenges in gaining acceptance with fellow players and fans.
It wasn't unusual in the day for kids like Greenberg, whose parents had emigrated from other countries, to feel separate or alienated from mainstream American culture. And what set Hank apart additionally was the fact that he was Jewish, and so he was a marked minority in the United States. And his parents, like many parents of their generation, didn't understand baseball and what it meant to America. Their ambition for their children, especially in coming to a new country and leaving behind the old world, was to provide better opportunity for their children. In Hank's family's case, that meant going to college. They had four kids. All four went to college. Hank was the only one who didn't finish college, much to his parents' dismay. But they'd wanted him to better himself, and he saw an opportunity to make a living and also to assimilate playing baseball. And so there was this natural conflict between immigrants and their children born here centered around baseball.
You quote Greenberg saying, with a chapter entitled The Elusive Hebrew Star, Greenberg says, "I was singled out all the time. Being Jewish and the object of a lot of derogatory remarks kept me on my toes all the time. I could never relax and be one of the boys." And that's a theme that comes through, is this sort of self-consciousness and inability to just sort of let go.
He always felt that he was not just a ball player, but a Jewish ball player. He very much wanted to be a ball player, just one of the guys. But he was forever identified as a Jewish ball player. Of course, back in the 30s, when he broke into the league, ethnic identification was much stronger, whether one's parents had come from Italy, Germany, Poland, or in Hank's case, Romania, as Orthodox Jews. There was a strong identification with that group. However, and there was also a viciousness among the bench jockeying and the comments from the fans, where they would yell ethnic slurs at players. The difference was that sometimes there are 3, 4, 5 Italians on the field to absorb those insults, or 3, 4, 5 Irish guys. But Hank was usually the only Jew on the field, and so he became this lone target to where he stood alone. He also played first base, which was often next to the other team's dugout, and so he was an easy target for them. He frequently was the object of derision and scorn directed at him, and particularly for being Jewish.
John, another scene that you point out relating to what you just said is Hank's returning as a Tiger to play at Yankee Stadium, to play New York. And you would think, having grown up in the Bronx, an area with a large Jewish community, his hometown, maybe there's a certain safety there. But no, as you just said, and again, this is from your book, you write, John, "The New York club often called up a minor leaguer specifically to harass Greenberg from the bench. If he got ejected for verbal abuse, the team didn't suffer. In one game, when a particularly vicious comment about Hank's Jewishness flew from the Yankee bench, Hank stomped over to the dugout and challenged the entire team to fight. No one stirred, though a couple of guys did say, 'Sorry.'" I love that scene. Not only for the imagery of Big Hank going over and challenging an entire baseball club to fight, but this idea that a player who might not be a key member in a particular game was actually assigned to this duty.
Yeah, Hank encountered the bigotry wherever he went. Yeah. It was in the stands. It was, as in this case, on the other team's bench. And the it was all part of that psychological warfare that teams engaged in. And so the Yankees would bring up this guy who, as you read, if he got ejected, it didn't hurt the team any, but he became sometimes a very valuable member of that team simply for the abuse he could hurl Hank's way and trying to get him off his game to distract him. Now, to Hank's credit, he frequently didn't back down from those insults, but he challenged them straight on, as in this case, or another time when he went into the Chicago clubhouse after a game and he said, I want the guy who called me a Jew bastard to say it to my face. And he walked around the room and nobody, he looked every player in the eye and the manager, and nobody spoke, of course. And as he left, one of Hank's teammates said, whoever said that was the luckiest guy around, because Hank would have torn him apart. But he other times responded with his bat, and that was where he gained a lot of respect as well, that he could channel his anger into success on the field, and it motivated him, it spurred him, because he wanted to be the best ball player, and he didn't want his Jewishness to be any sort of excuse, and so he pushed himself to become the best. Now, I should mention, too, that strong ethnic identification worked in his favor as well, because just as there were bigots that he encountered everywhere he went, he also encountered a special interest group of fans. Other Jews looked to Hank and cheered him because he was Jewish. That meant, you know, we went to St. Louis and New York and Philadelphia. There were fans that were rooting for Hank and against their team. Even in the World Series in Chicago, fans were rooting for Hank and against the Cubs simply because he was Jewish. So they were rooting for one of their own.
This is Peter Wharf for Current State. I'm talking with the author, John Rosengren. We're talking about John's new book, Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. John, you paint some very vivid pictures of these times of great turmoil that Hank Greenberg lived in, the depression and attendance plunging throughout the early years of Hank Greenberg's career. When he's just coming up, our country is really going down economically. You point out that attendance plunged in the league in one of his first full seasons, 1933, to just over 6 million fans. That's after having been over 10 million fans just a couple of years before. And you also talk about the social climate in Greenberg's Detroit Tiger town, specifically as it relates to Henry Ford and Father Coughlin of the Shrine of the Little Flower. Coughlin's red baiting and anti-Semitic messages, and then, of course, Ford's stance and his relationship with some of the German-related organizations of the 1930s.
Hank certainly entered a hostile environment when he came to Detroit. As you mentioned, his rookie year was 1933, and Henry Ford, the paterfamilias of the Motor City, was well known for his anti-Semitism. He was called the arch anti-Semite of America.
Yeah.
And he was an inspiration to Adolf Hitler, who had a picture of Henry Ford in his office and awarded Ford in 1938 on the occasion of his 75th birthday with the highest honor a non-German citizen could receive.
The Grand Cross of the Supreme Order of the German Eagle.
Yes. And Ford accepted that honor. So you've got Henry Ford there, and then, he, as you mentioned, Reverend Coughlin, the Roman Catholic priest in suburban Detroit, who had a radio show with 10 million listeners that eagerly lapped up his screeds against Jews as being out to ruin capitalism and bring down Christianity. So here comes Hank, and the Jews in Detroit were very much a minority population, only 5% of the population. So a lot of Detroiters didn't know any Jews, didn't have a point of reference for Jews, and just believed this stuff that Ford and Coughlin fed them, much as they did around the country. So he had that going against him. At the same time, there was the Depression, which hit the Motor City hard and had shuttered factories and extended soup lines around the corners. Yet Greenberg and the Tigers gave Detroit fans something to cheer about in 1934 when they clinched the pennant. Tiger fans were ecstatic. They thought it had been 25 years since they'd won a pennant, and now they had the chance to win it all. And baseball became a distraction and a positive diversion for people, a way to feel good about themselves in Detroit, where there wasn't much else to feel good about at the time.
Mr. Root looks over Mr. Greenberg, throws one in there, and there it is, Charlie, in the left field stands for a home run, and the Tigers have two more tallies.
We've talked a lot, John, about the opposition, to say the least, the hostile environment that Hank Greenberg faced during his career. But it's also interesting to note some of the close human connections that he made. And you mentioned very briefly, you paint a scene with Hank Greenberg and Ty Cobb. The Tiger great revealed his psychology of hitting to Hank. And that's sort of a curious scene to me, talking about a sometimes violent man who was known to be involved in hateful incidents, and yet he seemed to befriend, in some way, Hank Greenberg. Can you talk a little bit more about that story?
These two men who seem so different at first blush, as you mentioned, Cobb and Greenberg, shared in common the fact that they're both fiercely competitive and great hitters, students of the game. And Cobb, I think, welcomed Greenberg as a fellow Tiger to the city of Detroit, and so gave him this advice. He said how when he would go up and be in a tough situation, rather than feel intimidated by the pitcher, he'd look out at the pitcher and think, that poor SOB has to face the great Ty Cobb. And Greenberg realized the shift in mentality that could work in his favor and adopted it, and it gave him much more confidence as he came to the plate in pressure situations.
John Rosengren is the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes, published in 2013 by New American Library. John, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us about Hank Greenberg.
You're welcome, Peter. My pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
Koif mir den misslochen Cracker Jack, will ich kein Mul von dort nicht weg. It's a gut, mut die Ballspieler, es passt nicht als ein Verspiel. Weil sie sehen, zwei, drei Strikes neues bei der
And part two of Peter Wharf's interview with author John Rosengren comes up tomorrow here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Every Monday morning, we talk business and development and the economy with MLive's Angela Whitrock. And Angela joins me now. How are you?
I'm better after hearing that baseball segment.
Yeah, that was fun. And part two coming up tomorrow. Very interesting chapter in Detroit Tiger history. My first question for you this morning concerns the relationship between Lansing developer Pat Gillespie and the city. This was very interesting last week. MLive reported the city was actually at the point of considering suing Gillespie over construction delays on his marketplace project at Cedar and Shiawassee Street. Late on Friday, the city announced a revised agreement with a rough timeline for construction. What is this about?
You know, it's a very unusual and confusing development in this history of development. This corner is its riverfront property. It's tremendously important to the revitalization of downtown Lansing. The plan to, you know, get it underway and was sort of delayed by the economic crash of 08. And then was further delayed, according to Pat Gillespie, when the city asked him to stop work there because the casino plans came through. So, you know, what he had originally planned for that marketplace development was going to be impacted quite significantly by the proposed casino plans.
Yeah.
Then we hear that, you know, he's missed this January 2013 deadline to commence, which is not surprising given the casino delays as well. But what seems to have happened is that there is maybe not some agreement between the mayor's office and the office of the Economic Development Agency for the city, LEAP, between, you know, were they going to pursue legal action? Was anybody in trouble? It's very murky and unclear and, you know, frankly, quite puzzling. It doesn't seem to add up very well.
So it's not clear who it was that was getting frustrated enough to... I mean, Bob Trezise brought it up at the city council meeting last week, correct?
Correct, yes. At the Committee on Development and Planning, he said they're in violation. We are thinking of pursuing legal action. I talked to the city attorney, and she said she was reviewing the matter and would advise the council on further action. And then magically this statement comes out, and the mayor says in the statement, well, it's a very complex agreement. You know, he wasn't in violation. So, but we do have a new timeline. So, it, you know, there are all of these pinprick holes in this story here that we just don't have answers to yet. Was he in violation? Was there going to be legal action? Why isn't the statement made by Mr. Trezise in the meeting sort of lining up with the statement made by the mayor on Friday? And really, you know, why, if there's no big deal about this, why did we spend 4 days on it last week talking about it? You know, it's, you know, Pat's a pretty good developer around town. He is one of the few people who've gotten projects done in the last couple of years in the city. And so it's...
There are some who also argue that it's hardly in the city's best interest to provoke a developer with a track record like Pat Gillespie's, you know, when it's really trying to expand the economy and really needs as many good things going as possible.
Right, and, you know, it's also very puzzling because historically Pat and the mayor have had a really great working relationship. I mean, that's one reason why he was trusted to take over that really important marketplace property. It's a reason why he was able to do the Armory project. You know, between Pat and his brother Scott, they've done a lot in the town in the last couple of years. They've done it well. I don't think anybody who's been through the Armory would argue that it was not done well or that it wasn't a spectacular showpiece on the east side. So it is just puzzling. I mean, there's... I am befuddled by this whole situation.
Well, the whole thing seems to have settled down quite a bit, at least on the surface, since Friday's release from the city with the timeline. And I did get a text yesterday from Pat Gillespie. He told me, excited to get rolling on Marketplace. Downtown Lansing rental market is strong, and having more people live along the river in downtown will help existing businesses and help spur new ones. Bob Trezise emailed me early this morning. Project is a full go, and it's going to be an amazing addition to our riverfront. We'll be breaking ground this week. So I don't know. There appears to be a pretty serious attempt to smooth the whole thing over
right.
and move forward.
Well, we're thinking we might get some additional answers tonight. LEAP, which is the contracted economic development agency for the city, will be going before the city council tonight to go over their budget. And I assume that, you know, at least a few members of the city council will have some pretty tough questions for Bob and his team tonight about, you know, what the what with this kerfluffle all week.
You filed a neat story on Saturday on a new business in Old Town Lansing. Tell us about the Old Town General Store.
Well, this is, you know, a really fascinating story of a woman named Maria Vanetta who lived in Old Town growing up and wanted to come back and decided that she would come back once she found the right space to open a business. And
she lived in Old Town before it was Old Town?
Before it was Old Town. Yeah, this is like back in the 80s. And what she decided was that what Old Town needed was a place to grab something to eat that was not a sit-down restaurant. So she opened this general store on Friday, which by all accounts is doing very well initially. They have a great selection of, you know, bread and cheese and hummus and locally grown produce. And, you know, it's just fascinating that there's a little tiny grocery store now in Old Town.
I couldn't agree more. I think this is really intriguing. So, I mean, I've heard people have told me Old Town needs more retail. Now it's got one more. But I've been led to believe that food is like the last threshold,
right?
You know, because a lot of urban areas in particular don't want to become labeled as food deserts. And they've actually, it would appear, they've crossed that threshold.
Well, and what's really important, you know, you don't think of walkability and bikeability as having much to do with grocery shopping, right? But you think if you live in Old Town and you don't want to drive a car around all the time, it's pretty hard to get groceries. You can go to the city market, or you can sort of pick through things at Quality Dairy or just eat out a lot. Now, if you live, you know, within probably a mile of this place, it's not such a production to walk down, grab a loaf of bread, grab a hunk of cheese, maybe grab a bottle of wine, and there's a great dinner for
you.
So it's really, you know, tremendously important to this cool, hip, urban vibe that the city and that the businesses of Old Town and downtown have really been cultivating. So this is sort of the next genesis of that idea, and it's, you know, frankly, quite exciting.
When did she open?
Friday morning.
And she leads you to believe that she's off to a good start.
Yes,
you're a couple of days into it.
When I called to talk to her, the background noise was palpable. And, you know, frankly, for my coworkers and myself, I think we'll be there. I mean, Zingerman's cheese, Zingerman's bread.
Yeah, pretty cool. Speaking of thresholds, Tom Walsh of the Detroit Free Press reported yesterday that some Detroit officials are now optimistic enough about the city's future to launch a new marketing effort to attract convention business to the city. You kind of have to wonder what's a company that is planning a convention, what would lead them to choose Detroit, given all of the bad press that it's received over the years, but some people feel it's worth investing in the city in that way.
Well, this is, I actually have a little inside information for you.
Great.
The Detroit Visitors and Convention Bureau, they've been sort of aggressively marketing the city for a long time. And when my husband was in the nonprofit sector, we actually got to go on these wonderful marketing trips from the Convention and Visitors Bureau. And there actually is a lot of really great convention opportunity in Detroit. There's, you know, Cobo Center, there's the Renaissance, there's Motor City Casino. I mean, there are all these places where you could plop down 600 people, have a convention, and still have things to do. Now they want to take it up one more notch to sort of combat that image of Detroit modern ruins, Detroit ruin porn, you know, move it up and get more business in, because there is a lot to do, a lot to see. And if you're going to bring in 600 people or 1,000 people for a trade convention, it's really a great place to be.
Virge Bernero tweeted here this morning. He said, "It's about damn time." He was responding to the movement toward an internet sales tax. That's an opportunity for more city revenue, so it's not really surprising that he's going to back something like that. Any thoughts on this movement toward an internet sales tax? This would affect companies that sell things online that have some kind of physical profile here in the state of Michigan.
Well, I think the big question is what will happen. What's the next step? I mean, the Amazons of the world, you know, the big online-only retailers that don't have a physical presence, when will they get, you know, the same sort of treatment? But, you know, I think Bernero's right on this. It's about paying your fair share. It's about making sure that cities like Lansing are getting every bit of revenue that's due to them because, you know, frankly, those of us who do a lot of shopping online, I'm raising my hand here, I do a lot of shopping online, I didn't know I was supposed to be filling out a sales tax form. You know, who would be doing that?
Yeah.
You think that's something that they should be taking care of for you? And, you know, it's a question of fairness. You pay a sales tax at the grocery store, you should pay one online.
Mm-hmm. Is Jackson National apt to come up tonight at City Council? It seems like you've gone over the agenda for tonight at Lansing City Council. Do you know if that's coming up at all?
So far, I haven't seen it on tonight's agenda, but it'll go. What will happen is it'll come up first. They'll refer it to the Committee on Development and Planning, which is chaired by Brian Jeffries. He's assured me that you know, he's supportive of it. He doesn't see any roadblocks in the future for Jackson National Life's expansion. So I assume that'll get rolling pretty quickly because they do want to get, you know, shovels in the ground and get that expansion started. They're already in close quarters and pretty crowded, so they want to start moving up.
Nicely attended grand opening reception last week, too, at M Live in downtown Lansing.
Yes, it was.
Everybody's firing on all cylinders now.
Yes, we are. We are loving our new space. We are loving downtown, and we encourage everyone who's able to come on by and say hi.
That's neat. Angela Whitrock of M Live. Thanks, Angela.
Thanks, Mark.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll speak with the director of the film Detroit Unleaded. The film focuses on the personalities who come and go at a gas station in the Motor City. Also, we'll discuss the health of beaches around the Great Lakes. That and more Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.